of all time, and perhaps the most expensive. Comparisons were drawn between it and Gone with the Wind, and there was a great deal of secrecy about who was playing the lead role of Paul Atreides, Kyle MacLachlan. When the actor was interviewed on television, his back was to the camera. It was one of the most coveted screen roles in years. His Seattle phone number, known only to a few people, was 547-DUNE. It may have been the most heavily promoted movie in history. Months before the film came out, toys and other novelty items were made available, in addition to Avalon Hill's Dune board game, which had been out for years. There were toy sandworms and Paul Atreides dolls, Dune weapons, obsidian paperweights with House Atreides gold hawks on them, T-shirts, posters, games, soundtrack record albums and tapes, calendars, puzzles, and mazes. Merchandisers had to pay Universal Studios as much as $100,000 apiece for the rights to produce spin-off products. A mind-boggling assortment of spin-off books appeared as well, plus reissued Frank Herbert books. Almost everything he had ever published went back into print or had its press run increased. Most of the books were published by Berkeley Putnam. In addition to reprints and special boxed sets of all the books in the Dune series, they came out with The Art of Dune, The Dune Storybook, Dune Activity Book, Dune Coloring Book, Dune Coloring and Activity Book, Dune Cutout Activity Book, Dune Pop-Up Panorama Book, and a book about the movie production entitled The Making of Dune, and a speculative compendium about the worlds of Dune entitled The Dune Encyclopedia. Every envelope and parcel mailed by Berkeley Putnam during the year was stamped in red letters, The Year of Dune. Universal Studios established a Dune fan club, and in only a few weeks had several thousand members. Under arrangement with Lifetime Learning Systems, Universal also developed the World of Dune Teaching Kit, which was given to 4,000 middle and high school teachers in the United States and Canada. Walden Books came out with a contest, the World of Dune Sweepstakes. The winner received a trip to Los Angeles and a dinner with Frank Herbert. Walden Books also produced and distributed interviews of Frank Herbert and David Lynch on cassette tape. The film's budget was variously quoted between $40 and $60 million, production numbers that were at the time astronomical. Universal Studios had a promotional budget of an additional $8 million. They announced the movie would be released just before Christmas 1984, timed to obtain the most attention for Academy Award nominations. Promoters, eager to take advantage of Christmas shoppers and follow in the footsteps of Star Wars merchandising, which had brought in $3 billion in revenues in addition to movie ticket sales, tried to promote Dune in the same manner, with toys, coloring books, and the like aimed at children and teenagers. Frank Herbert did not object to the merchandising, saying the investors needed to do it in order to maximize their profits, and the movie might never have been made without the prospect of such additional earnings. But from the beginning, I had my doubts about this approach. I knew from fan mail that young people read the Dune books, but they were a decided minority. The books were far too intellectual for most people in that age group. As weeks passed, many fans were put off by glitzy, misdirected promotions, and sales on the novelty items were slow. In the midst of all this, Dad signed on to do a Pacific Bell television commercial, which would run during prime time and special events, including the Super Bowl. In the commercial, Frank Herbert stood in front of an alien backdrop, looking rather different without his beard from the way his fans were accustomed to seeing him. He spoke of a subject he knew very well, the future. Around September, when Dad was leaving for California, he was telling people he liked what he had seen of the film. When asked about it, he frequently kissed his fingertips and exclaimed, "They're capturing the essence of my book, doing it just right." His contract with Dino De Laurentiis didn't allow him to publicly criticize the film, but Dad always said if he didn't like it, he would remain silent. He really did like it, and was extremely excited. He predicted that it would be a cult movie, and in the innovative hands of David Lynch, felt it would be a breakthrough film as well, exploring ground that had never before been covered on film. In early December, Dad took his new love, Teresa Shackelford, to a world premiere of the movie at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. President and Mrs. Reagan were among more than 1,000 in attendance. Also present were stars of the movie, including Kyle MacLachlan, Dean Stockwell, and Francesca Annis. The building had been decorated to look like the Palace of Arrakeen on the planet Dune, and it housed an enthusiastic audience. After the movie, one woman kept saying, "Wow, wow, oh wow." A state dinner at the White House followed, at which the President and Mrs. Reagan told Dad they had enjoyed the movie. The group health premiere would be held the following week in Seattle. Dad would come up by himself from Los Angeles and would escort his favorite aunt, Peggy Roundtree, to the event. Dad was given 50 tickets for his friends and family, and I coordinated the guest list, making doubly certain that each invitee would attend before mailing out tickets. This was on top of all the Man of Two Worlds work, our Hawaii trip preparations, the handling of Dad's voluminous paperwork, including the accumulation of data needed for his 1984 taxes, and the preparation of my own taxes, all of which had to be done before we could leave in early January. On the afternoon of Tuesday, December 11th, 1984, Jan and I picked up Penny and her husband Ron at the airport, then met Dad in his hotel suite at the Four Seasons Olympic Hotel in Seattle. My brother and his gay lover were already there when we arrived. Dad looked natty in his 35-year-old tuxedo, with a ruffled white shirt and a black bow tie. Gold cufflinks glimmered at the sleeves. I took him aside, and we discussed a number of his pressing income tax and legal matters. We spoke of Man of Two Worlds as well, and Dad said we might create a mushy monster in the story, perhaps a dragon that runs away when kids throw rocks at it. At 5 p.m., all of us walked across the street to a Dune reception at the Rainier Bank Tower. The reception was held on the 40th floor, which afforded a panoramic view of Seattle and Elliott Bay. Guests were dressed in tuxedos and jewel-bedecked evening gowns. The hors d'oeuvres and wines were first class. Mayor Royer of Seattle was present, along with a number of other notables, including mountain climber Jim Whittaker. At 7 o'clock, the family members and VIPs were taken in three limousines to the King Cinema a mile away. Powerful spotlights stood in front of the theater, crisscrossing beams of light through the night sky. We filed into a reserved loge area and sat in big, soft seats. A murmuring air of anticipation filled the theater, as everyone wondered how close the movie would come to Frank Herbert's masterpiece. At 7:30, Dad walked down to the stage in front of the curtained screen and spoke to a full house, introducing the movie. He said it had been a long time in the making, and gave a brief history of earlier attempts, including mention of Hodorowski's plan for a 14-hour epic and a subsequent screenplay that would have made an incest movie about Paul and his mother. Upon learning of the incest concept, the audience gasped. All along, Dad had been correct in asserting that his fans would never tolerate anything like that. When he spoke poignantly about Mom and the reasons for the group health benefit, including her initial efforts in setting it up shortly before her death, his voice broke, and he could hardly speak. He closed by saying, "This is for Bev," then stood there looking very lonely and sad. The audience gave him a standing ovation, and then, head down to conceal his tears, he walked back to his seat. The curtain went up, the lights dimmed, and Toto's magnificent soundtrack filled our ears. It was a widescreen, best for this particular film, and soon I found myself immersed into the story. The desert scenes were spectacular, bringing to mind an alien Lawrence of Arabia. The atmosphere in the Palace of Arrakeen was Shakespearean, with dark mysterious rooms and corridors, and scheming plotting characters. When Paul rode the giant sandworm, chills ran down my spine. The audience clapped and cheered when Elias stabbed the Baron Harkonnen with a Gom-Jabbar needle and thrust him into the jaws of a sandworm, a slight variation from the book, in which he slumped over in his suspensers, dead from the Gom-Jabbar. When the film finished and the lights went back on, I looked at my father, who was in my row two seats away. He was staring at the screen, transfixed, eyes open wide and face almost expressionless. An empty box of popcorn lay at his feet. For nearly an hour, Dad signed movie programs and books until his hand ached and he could do no more. He said he had forgotten to bring along the wristband that gave him additional strength for marathon signings. A short while later, in an interview on national television, Dad mentioned the novel we were writing together. The interviewer asked him if I was really a good writer or if Frank Herbert was only doing something to help his son. Dad's eyebrows arched at the rude inquiry, and he responded, "The acorn didn't fall far from the oak tree." Forbes magazine said Dune might become the first billion-dollar movie, far surpassing the revenues of any other motion picture in history. Dad thought this was entirely possible. Based upon book sales, he said the movie had a built-in audience of 50 million people, and many of them would want to see it over and over, just as they read and reread the book. In the opening weeks, as expected, crowds lined up to purchase tickets. Going along with the movie, book sales skyrocketed, and the paperback edition of Dune reached number one on the New York Times bestseller list. "It's highly unusual for this to happen nearly 20 years after publication," Dad told me. In honor of the occasion, his publisher had the list from the newspaper enlarged and framed for him. For the week of January 6, 1985, it showed Dune number one, ahead of novels by Danielle Steele and Stephen King. Chapter 42, Bridge Over Troubled Water. Mom's ceremony would be held at Kawaloa on February 7, 1985, the first anniversary of her passing. While we found a cruise ship to take us there late in January, there were no return voyages until June. As a consequence, Jan and I made arrangements to live in the house at Kawaloa through June, taking our children with us and putting them in public school for that time. We had high hopes of making an adventure out of it and that it would be an alternate cultural encounter for my children, somewhat like experiences I'd had in Mexico in the 1950s. In mid-January 1985, before boarding the ship in San Francisco, Jan and I drove further south to Manhattan Beach near Los Angeles to visit my father. He had asked me to bring a typewriter to him, and I assumed he meant his vintage 1970 Olympia Electric. It turned out to be the wrong one. He wanted the tiny portable he had used in London to work on the screenplay of Flash Gordon for Dino De Laurentiis. This time, after a moment's displeasure, he forgot about my perceived failure and nothing more was said about it. But it reminded me of a plethora of other small failings that I, my siblings, or my children had committed before his eyes, not performing according to his exacting standards. It was frustrating for me, trying to please this man. I was 37, but around him I often felt like a small child, unable to meet my father's expectations. It made me think about something that hadn't occurred to me, and I made new notes for my journal, notes that would help me to better understand myself. In recent years, as I strove to become a writer, I had been asking my father questions not only about writing, but about science and math and history and any number of things, much as a curious child might do. I hadn't asked nearly as many questions when I had been small, since he had not been available for me. Now that he was available and we had dramatically improved our relationship, I was doing a lot of catching up. For a brief time, we met his auburn-haired girlfriend, Teresa. Shy and intellectual, she seemed quite nice and paid special attention to Margot. Then she left for an appointment. Bookshelves lined many walls of the apartment, and it had a large, cheerful kitchen filled with state-of-the-art cooking devices. In his loft office, a little nook reached by climbing a separate stairway, Dad proudly showed me an extensive assortment of new camera gear he had purchased for the Himalayas trip the following year. We spoke again of making the trip together, and looked forward to it. Having gone as far as I could on Man of Two Worlds, I gave him a complete copy of the manuscript, as much as I had written thus far. He said he would get busy on it after completing a screenplay for the Santa Rosa Barrier. "I have a Harold Lloyd chase scene in the screenplay," he said, "where the person chased doesn't know he's being chased." I also had with me his uncompleted manuscript of Circle Times, a historically accurate story about Northwest Salish Indians, a project he had abandoned in the 1970s. Having read it carefully, I had a number of suggestions I thought might improve the pacing and organization of the story, and he liked my ideas. We made plans to collaborate on the book when time allowed. "First, I'm going to write Dune 7," he said. "Another one?" He smiled and said, "I can't seem to let go of the series." I asked him how the Dune movie was doing, and he said it was setting box office records overseas. The results were not as clear in the United States, he added. I asked him what he meant, but he didn't seem anxious to talk about it. On a file cabinet in his office were the framed list of bestsellers and the Dune movie clapboard he had used ceremoniously to begin the filming in March 1983. The board had written on it, "Dune, Slate 1, Take 1." I gave him an autographed copy of my latest paperback novel, The Garbage Chronicles. Just as he often wrote messages from father to son in the books he gave me, I now reversed it, with a message from the son to the father. On January 20, 1985, Jan, Margot, and I boarded the SS Independence in San Francisco. Julie and Kim were flying to Hawaii separately because of conflicting schedules. In the ship's lounge, we saw Dad in the Pacific Bell commercial during a break in the Super Bowl game. "Pop, pop," Margot squealed. Upon arriving in Honolulu, Jan and Margot flew a Royal Hawaiian Air Service Cessna to Maui, while I chartered a 32-foot sailboat. It was more than 30 miles to Molokai, the first landfall. We sailed in moderate winds at first, but the wind died down and we had to motor. Unfortunately, the boat motored at only 2 or 2.5 knots. It was painfully slow. We proceeded in this way all night, and instead of anchoring at Molokai as planned, we made directly for Lahaina on the island of Maui. I alternated at the helm with the skipper, and we slept in shifts. When we were out in the big water, I asked the skipper where the lifeboat was, thinking he must have an inflatable raft stowed somewhere. To my surprise, he said rather casually, "I thought about it, but never got around to it." "Oh," I said in a small voice. How ironic my situation was, taking this route because I thought it was safer. The boat had a ship-to-shore radio, flares, and life jackets. But on the radio I heard a Coast Guard report of another boat taking on water in its number one hold. It was a clear night and the blackest sky I had ever seen. Stars glimmered along the horizon to the south, and to the west where the sun had set was a bright star or planet. There were shooting stars and luminous iridescent flying fish. As morning broke, we passed the island of Lanai and the vast Dole pineapple fields. A porpoise swam alongside the starboard bow, and in the Auau Channel, approaching the Maui town of Lahaina, we saw a dozen humpback whales. It was impressive watching them flop their monstrous black tails and blow water through their spouts. Jan was supposed to pick me up in Lahaina with Dad's Chevrolet Blazer, but it was out of commission in a repair shop with a rusted-out fuel pump. We borrowed an old pickup truck from the mechanic. The Hana Road. That legendary and foreboding passage between a tourist civilization on one side of Maui and an old Hawaiian way of life carved out of the jungle on the other, passed more than 50 waterfalls. The road was bumpy, and we had to drive it in a light rain, with night fast approaching. There were crumbling turn-of-the-century bridges and cliffs dropping off to the sea. We passed ferny jungles of bamboo, breadfruit, papaya, and mango trees, and a most interesting tree called the hala or lauhala, Pandanus odoratissimus. Known as the walking tree, the hala had large, finger-like aerial roots above the ground that seemed to prop the tree up and were said to walk across the land, shifting the tree's position slightly as the roots extended. It was a treacherous stretch of road, requiring more than 3 hours to drive 53 miles, but it wasn't nearly as bad as I had heard. The tropical smells and verdant greens were reminiscent of Mexico, as were the simple huts and fruit stands we passed, and the old rattling pickup in which we rode.
Dented, rusted, rattly old vehicles were a way of life in such places.
Front-end alignment? Forget it. At a gravel parking area adjacent to the apartment wing on Dad's property, caretakers Bart and Sheila Rast helped us unload the truck, groceries, office supplies, and luggage. A blonde man in his 30s, Bart stood around 6 feet tall with a pleasant weathered face. Sheila was dark-haired and pretty. Both were well-tanned. They shared an interest in flowers and cats. In centuries past, this eastern shore of Maui had been a favored area for Hawaiian royalty. They had summer homes, court baths, down the road at Seven Pools, and royal coconut groves, which, according to legend, were groves of palm trees planted by powerful chiefs. On the afternoon of our first full day in this magical place, Jan and I walked down to the craggy black lava rocks that rimmed the property, where we saw waves crashing against the shore some 20 or 30 feet below us, foaming white around the rocks and throwing spray high in the air. The water all around the white foam was turquoise and aquamarine, in subtle variations of color. It was as Jan had described, unlike any water I had seen before. Behind us, not far from the shore, stood the wide-boughed, graceful kamani tree where my mother's ashes would be spread. We saw a humpback whale 100 yards offshore, indicating deep water a short distance out. In one of the tidal pools, framed in black rock beneath our perch, Jan spotted a fish, and if I'd had a net handy, I would have gone down there and tried to catch it. We found a cave secreted in the rocks as well, with a small amount of debris to indicate that fishermen had camped there recently. On the grassy expanse between the house and shore were rustic rock walls only a couple of feet high, property lines from centuries past, when the Hawaiian royal family issued land grants that extended from the top of the volcano Haleakala all the way down to the sea. Some of the walls were the remnants of a Filipino village that had once been on the site. Ka'awaloa. A nice long time. I wished my mother had been able to live here longer. We went to a big luau that evening, a Hawaiian feast where much beer and good food was consumed. It was in honor of a baby's first birthday, and in ensuing weeks we would learn that luaus were given to celebrate a wide variety of events. At shortly past 2 p.m. on February 3, 1985, I picked up Dad at Hana Airport in the old pickup, since his Blazer still had not been repaired. A strong wind blew as he got off the two-engine prop plane, causing the gate between the tiny terminal building and the landing strip to swing and creak. In the truck, Dad told me that both Dune and Dune Messiah were now on the New York Times paperback bestseller list. I showed him the new cover for Arbor House's upcoming hardcover edition of my third novel, Sudana, Sudana, along with two excellent national reviews on the book. "I told you it was a good story," Dad said. My father and I walked around the property, and in familiar fashion, he told me about all the future construction ideas he had for Kawaloa. Dad said he planned another apartment beneath the house for a maid or gardener, plus a concrete parking area under the house and a screened-in dining room on what was now an outside deck by the present dining room. He had run short on funds the year before, but eventually he intended to have blue Italian tile installed in a gazebo already built by the swimming pool. Adjacent to the gazebo, cut out of the steep, flower-covered hillside that ran up to the caretaker's house, would be a waterfall and a carp pond. At dinner that evening, we heard the smacking click-click-click of a gecko, tiny lizard, coming from somewhere on the exposed beams over our head. Dad said he welcomed them in the house, as they ate insects and were considered good luck by the natives. Dad said he planned to do a screenplay for a pilot film after our collaboration was completed. The pilot film, for what he hoped would be a television series, was to be entitled Nashville, about power, politics, and love in the Deep South. When that was completed, he would write Dune 7, followed by his trip to Nepal in the spring of 1986, then a documentary film and a book on that. A third book with Bill Ransom would follow, set in the same universe as their prior collaborations, The Jesus Incident and The Lazarus Effect. Sometime in 1987, he hoped to be able to start the new book with me about Northwest Salish Indians, based upon his Circle Times manuscript. Frank Herbert would not sleep on the king-size bed in the master bedroom, since his beloved wife had passed away on it. He wanted to sleep in his study. So beneath the skylight, by a bookcase-lined wall where he had many poetry books, we set up a lounge chair that was folded open into a cot, and placed a Japanese futon mattress on top. It couldn't have been very comfortable, but he didn't complain. His roll-top desk stood against the wall opposite the cot, with a makeshift table between. The table was a flat door stained black, set on top of a pair of two-drawer black file cabinets. Three manuscript boxes were stacked on top by a small pile of my father's business cards. His card was white and simple, with Frank Herbert in the upper left corner, and a line beneath that extended the width of the card. In the lower left corner it said simply, "Hana, Hawaii, USA, 96713. We had all of Dad's mail forwarded to us in Hawaii, and I worked on his paperwork the following day. That afternoon, Margot was riding a tricycle on the deck at Kawaloa, yelling and screaming with exuberance. At around 4:30, Dad, who was preparing dinner, emerged from the kitchen to announce that he couldn't work while Margot was screaming. "It just does something to my head." He stood in the living room, staring at Margot through the screen door, refusing to work on dinner anymore until we did something about her. It made me think of times as a child when our house had to be absolutely quiet, to the point where I wasn't able to bring my friends over. Julie, now 16, was watching television when Dad went into his routine, and she thought his behavior was so out of line that she left the room without comment. Later, she told Jan that Grandpa had not been treating her very well either. "He used to be nice," Julie said. "Actually, my eldest daughter was just beginning to see a more complete picture of a complex man. We explained to her that this was a terrible time for him, coming back to Kawaloa for the ceremony, and stress seemed to bring out the most difficult side of his personality. Besides that, he seemed tired, undoubtedly from not sleeping well. I was frustrated by the situation because I probably knew better than anyone how important strong family ties were to my father. Over the years, he had often expressed an interest in setting up a family business, since he believed in strong family ties. Now a number of us, Penny, Ron, Jan, and me, had pulled together and were working for him. Penny and Ron were living in Port Townsend now as caretakers, and Penny was handling fan letters. Jan was helping me with the astounding piles of paperwork generated around the phenomenon known as Frank Herbert, and besides that, she was working on the interior design of a new caretaker's house that Dad wanted to build in Port Townsend for Penny and Ron. Around 8 o'clock that evening, Dad said he wasn't feeling well and went to bed, saying he thought he was coming down with something. In the middle of the night, he was awakened by Julie's stereo. First, he went out to the guest apartment and asked her to turn it down. When she didn't turn it down far enough, he went out a second time, got into an argument with her, and took the stereo away from her. The following day, a Tuesday, Dad awoke, perhaps not surprisingly, in a foul mood. I found aspirin for him. A few minutes later, he was scolding me for allegedly leaving two kitchen utensils in the left sink, where they could fall into the garbage disposal. I had not done it and told him so. But he kept raving about it, on and on. He was also on an uncompromising mission to make certain that all the closet doors in the house were kept closed in order to ward off moist sea air that might get in, and about keeping drawers shut for the same reason, and about keeping plastic over certain things. Moisture was a big problem here, especially on metal objects, so he had set up dry rooms in all of the closets and in a large pantry off the kitchen, using electric heat rods that I had purchased for him in Seattle. The pantry was the largest dry room. When the house was shut down, and each night, he stuffed these special rooms with everything he thought might be subject to damage. Now, with us in the house, he was nervous about maintaining his carefully designed system. I said I understood his concerns, and promised to monitor the dry rooms for him. Julie and Kim, now enrolled in the local public school, were on holiday due to teachers' conferences, and Jan took them to Hamoa Beach to escape their grandfather's constant haranguing. For the same reason, I jogged 3 miles on the Hana Road in the direction of Kaupo Gap, away from Hanatown, running up long, steep Drummond Hill. When Jan returned later in the afternoon, I gave Margot a swimming lesson. By then, Dad was feeling better, and on the mezzanine he went through a box of his mother's family pictures with me, marking the backs of photos to show who people were. He had photos of himself as a 2-year-old with his head bandaged from a severe dog bite, and for the first time I saw pictures of colorful small-town characters he had described, and of his favorite grandmother, Mary Stanley Herbert. It was exhilarating for me, matching faces with stories that I had been hearing him tell for years. He gave me a number of pictures and asked me to ship the rest to him on the mainland. At 5 p.m., Jan and I went with Dad to visit Dr. Milton Howell, my mother's doctor, sharing hors d'oeuvres with him and his wife Roselle at their house. Dr. Howell was tanned, curly-haired, and relaxed. He wore shoes and socks, and I wondered how he kept from getting sweaty feet in the Hawaiian climate. His wife was stocky and peppery, an affable, generous woman. She loaned me 2 autographed books that had been given to her by her close friend, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, wife of Charles Lindbergh.
They were Gift from the Sea, written by AML herself, and Autobiography of Values by her late husband.
I felt honored and took extra care with the treasures. Dad told the Howells we were doing a book together, one that would knock down a lot of the conventions in science fiction. This had never been mentioned to me before, and I remained silent. I was shocked. What did he mean? And I'd already written my part. In Frank Herbert, William Tuponce postulated that Man of Two Worlds is obviously a send-up of many science fiction themes, creator figures and races, their responsibilities, and the chance that humankind may be a casual toy. That evening we went to Fray Nutley's place for dinner. A large woman in her 80s, she was the mother of NBC television news correspondent Garrick Utley and a radio personality in her own right back in the 1940s and 1950s in Chicago, with her late husband Clifton. Frayn wore a red muumuu with white flowers on it. She was jovial, alert, and talkative. While cooking dinner, she scolded her two black cats repeatedly and chased them out of the house. They kept sneaking back in, so perhaps this was a little game played by master and pet. The dinner conversation was largely political. As we were leaving, Frayn invited Jan and me to monthly concerts held at her house. This would involve listening to music from her extensive recording collection. She said she started the concerts a dozen years before with her husband, and it became a popular event in the Hana area, attended regularly by 40 or more guests. We promised to attend. My mother's ceremony would be in 2 days. Whenever Dad spoke of it to friends, he explained that it wasn't going to be a formal service and that there would be no holy man. "Bev made me promise to keep it simple," he said, "and I don't want her coming back to haunt me." The next day I read Gift from the Sea, from cover to cover. It was the perfect book to read on this paradise island, and spoke a great deal about the need people have to be alone. I had that need, and Jan spoke of requiring it for herself as well. It wasn't that we wanted to be apart, but we needed our individual quiet times, times that improved our relationship. Personal space. My father had always demanded his own personal space, but paradoxically, he often didn't allow people close to him the same privilege. He had a tendency to smother people with his dominance. Not intentionally, of course. Not even selfishly. He simply didn't realize he was doing it. A contractor stopped by, and Dad told him to build gates for the swimming pool to keep Margot from getting in without supervision. Dad was very concerned about her safety. Two more excellent reviews came in on Sudana Sudana, and I recall standing on the mezzanine by the stairway telling Dad about them. He was below me in the living room reading, on the big gray sectional couch. He looked up at me, and after congratulating me, he said, "Even bad reviews sell books, Brian. Best of all is a bad review from the New York Times. That sells at least 10,000 copies for me." He went on to say emphatically that he cared more about sales than about critics, because if his works were selling, the fans were telling him they liked his work. Fans were the only reviewers who mattered to him. When Jan brought Margot home from preschool at around 4 o'clock that afternoon, our daughter had a new plastic lunch pail from Hasegawa's general store. She ran into the kitchen with it to show her grandfather. But Dad was already talking with Jan, and he told Margot to be quiet. She went away dejected, and he never did ask her what she wanted. Dad loved Margot dearly, but didn't always have the patience for her. She had boundless energy, much as he'd had as a child. The adult Frank Herbert, I am certain, would have booted the child Frank Herbert out of the house. Ron, Penny, and their youngest son Robert, 15, arrived shortly after that, having rented a car in Kahului and driven the tortuous Hana Road. My sister had gotten sick along the way from all the curves. Bill Ransom and Dr. William and Z. Shire arrived, too, from Port Townsend. We shared dinner. It was one of Dad's specialties, sukiyaki, with the added ingredients shrimp and nenue, pilot fish, caught the day before by Julie. She said she caught 3 of them, having been shown how to fish with a bamboo pole by her new Hawaiian girlfriends. They used shrimp for bait. At dinner, Bill Ransom said there had been some confusion about the completion date on their new collaboration, which they were going to call The Swimmers. It had been my father's understanding that it had to be completed by November 1987, but the actual date required by the contract was a year earlier, November 1986. Bill had recently begun work on the project and said he had to complete his portion prior to September 1986, when he would begin classes in nursing. Bill also mentioned a British publisher of one of the earlier collaborations, who printed the name Frank Herbert in huge letters on the cover, with Bill Ransom in small print on the back cover, as if he were a reviewer. The publisher received a heated letter from the reviewer, and deservedly so, considering all the work that Bill had contributed. On the day we looked forward to, and dreaded, I arose early and ran 3 miles toward Capo Gap. It was overcast, and in the breezes I smelled thick sea air and dew-moistened earth, redolent with pungent, decaying vegetation that had soaked into it. Later, after breakfast, I went to my upstairs office to write in my journal. Ron and Jan joined me, and we talked about Dad's reputation around Hannah as an aggressive driver, and about a number of incidents that had occurred over the years with him at the wheel. When he wanted to get from point A to point B, he was so goal-oriented, as he was in the rest of his life, that he sometimes made dangerous passing maneuvers, even on the right shoulder of the road. Now, on top of Dad's luggage in his study was a book entitled Expert Driving, and he had plans to pick up a new Porsche Turbo, top speed 180 miles per hour, on his next trip to Europe. At shortly before 2 in the afternoon, many friends of Mom and Dad, mostly locals, started arriving. Dad took me aside and said, "We're going to use the past to make the future more pleasant. Bev wanted it that way, and I do too." He told all of us to wait on the deck on the water side of the main house, and at a little before 2:30, he went off alone to the Kamani tree several hundred feet below us, just above the cracky shoreline. He wore dark blue pants and a blue Hawaiian shirt with white flowers on it, and in his right hand, he carried a bag that bore the urn containing my mother's remains. He stood below the large spreading tree and motioned to one of the guests, Danny Estacada, a local musician. Danny was too choked up to play and sing the song that Mom wanted, so he had a cassette player, which he turned on. We heard Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel, representing what my parents had become for one another in their times of need. As the music played, Dad opened the bag and removed the urn. I saw him spread a thick dusting of ashes beneath the tree. Tears blurred my vision. I watched Dad moving around the tree, and then I looked down to the expanse of grass and old lava rock Hawaiian walls between the house and the tree. Jan cried softly at my side, and we held each other tightly. Jan pulled Kim close to her on the other side. "Like a bridge over troubled water, I will ease your mind." Water. I thought of Dune, of the most precious commodity on the planet, water, and the saying of the people when a person passed away. The water of my mother's life was gone. With the music still playing, I watched Dad walk back up a tire-tracked area of the grass. As he reached the edge of his landscaped yard, a huge wave hit the rocks behind him, just beyond the Kamani tree, sending white spray high in the air. It was spectacularly beautiful, this place my mother had chosen. I understood why she wanted to die here, refusing to go to a hospital. After scattering the ashes, Dad remained alone under the deck somewhere, undoubtedly crying and trying to compose himself. I never saw him cry that day, although he looked near it a number of times. That evening he was in a pretty good mood considering the circumstances, undoubtedly relieved at getting the service behind him. At a luau the next evening, I spent a lot of time talking with one of Dad's contractors. He was a likable fellow, with dark skin and a quick smile. Beneath the charming exterior, I detected glimpses of a tough businessman, and I let him know that I could be just as tough in negotiating the final tasks to be done on Dad's property, a responsibility that had been given to me. The following day, I had a lunch appointment with Bill Ransom. He telephoned late in the morning and moved the time back to 1:30. When I subsequently met him at the Hana Ranch coffee shop, he said Dad showed up that morning at his door at the Aloha Cottage in Hana, saying he wanted to talk story, and that this was the only time he could do it. After they talked for a while, Dad dragged Bill off to lunch, and Bill ate lightly, saving room for a second lunch with me. Bill spoke of a number of contractual matters on the books he and Dad had written together, and about the newest project. At my father's instruction, the contract for the latest collaboration had been drawn up under the title The Swimmers. Upon seeing this, Peter Israel, president of G.P. Putnam Sons, called Bill to say he didn't like the title at all. Bill agreed and offered a better one that ultimately was accepted by all concerned, the Ascension Factor. Our table overlooked the Hana Road and a sweeping stretch of pasture that extended to the sea. Bill expressed gratitude toward Frank Herbert for the opportunities given to him. He also told me of fond feelings he held for my mother and of his compassion for her. When he stayed at Kawaloa for 4 months in 1982, he would jog along the road and then come back to the house, perspiring.
On one such occasion, Mom said to him, "I hate you when you run."
Thereafter, Bill did his running elsewhere. and he felt it reflected her terrible frustration at her own weakened body. That afternoon, I worked in the office at Kawaloa. An hour before we were scheduled to go to Mary Moore's for dinner, Dad came upstairs and stood in the doorway between my office and his study. On the wall beside him was a massive built-in bookcase filled with his titles, many of them rare first editions. But now this phenomenal man did not speak about matters of great note, about philosophy or religion or history or science or any of the other wondrous things he knew. He simply said, in an irritated tone, "Would you help me keep the pantry door closed? They just left it open again." "I've already spoken with them," I said, seething. I slammed my pen down on the ledger, tried every method I knew to calm down. But this was the proverbial last straw, and I blew. The door of Mom's office was open, and Dr. and Mrs. Shire, from Port Townsend, were sitting just below us in the living room, waiting to go to dinner. Penny and Ron were with them. At the top of my voice, I told my father I was sick of the nitpicking, and that I had tried to help him with everything he wanted. "You want the dishwasher loaded just so. The forks have to be tines down. The spoons can't be together. The closet doors have to be left shut at all times, and the pantry door has to be kept shut. Well, the pantry door is set to stay open when pushed all the way open by the hinges on it. Change the hinges. All of us are mourning Mom, not just you. Can't you understand that?" In a sense, I had been egged on, because almost everyone in the family had been complaining to me about his nitpicking, about his moods. But I was unkind, I'm afraid, and my father looked crushed. Without a word, he went into his study and closed the door softly behind him. Presently, Penny came up and called through the door, telling him it was time to leave for dinner. Dad said he wasn't going. I felt angry and dejected, and told Penny I was in no mood to go either. I asked Jan to stay too, to mediate in case I got into another argument with Dad. Shortly after the others left, Jan and I heard Dad sobbing. I was still angry, and closed down my office to go outside and sit on the deck. Jan pleaded with me to go upstairs and make up with him. She said his tears were his way of apologizing, that he wasn't a man who could say he was sorry in so many words. "I can't go up there for you," she said. "It wouldn't be the same. Please, Brian, I can't stand to hear him crying." I took a deep breath, went inside, and climbed the circular staircase to the second floor. The sobbing coming from the other side of the door was unbearable, and I hurried into his study. Dad was lying on his back on the futon cot we had set up for him. He had a blanket pulled up to his waist and wore no shirt, revealing blonde hairs on his chest. He held one arm over his eyes and forehead. "Dad," I said, "I'm sorry." He wiped his eyes and looked at me in the saddest, most doleful manner. His head was propped up by a small pillow. All my anger washed away. I told him I loved him and that he was a wonderful, sensitive man. He looked more pitiful than anyone I had ever seen in my life, with tears all over his face and pained red-streaked eyes. I knelt on the hardwood floor by him, and he said he loved me too. I hugged him, and he held me tightly while still crying. The skin and hair on his chest were moist with perspiration, and his face was wet against mine from tears and from the heat of the hottest room in the house. "I didn't mean to nitpick," he said, in a voice choked with emotion. Then he said something that devastated me. "I built this house for your mother. I was just trying to maintain it the way she would have wanted." He put on a fresh Hawaiian shirt and came down to join Jan and me for white wine and a light meal. It had surprised me how readily my father, this once powerful and aggressive man, had folded in the face of my onslaught. I worried about his vulnerability. It had been a year since my mother's death, but he didn't seem to be getting over it, didn't seem to be coping well, as she had so desperately wanted him to do. It had been the essence of her plan. My dispute with Dad came only hours after a less vociferous argument he'd had with Penny. She and Ron had rented a car for the week, and he virtually commandeered it that day, without telling her where he was or when the car would be returned. When Jan checked Dad's horoscope, she discovered that he was forecast to have trouble with his children, but not until Sunday, the next day. His trouble came a few hours early. Chapter 43. Ho-hum, another day in paradise. In the four additional months we spent in Hawaii after my mother's services, Jan placed fresh flowers under the kamani tree each time she jogged or took long walks. One afternoon I gathered mango and passion fruit that lay on the ground, then went for a jog along the rut-filled Hana Road. The air was moist from a recent rain. After coming down Drummond Hill on the way back, my approach flushed a ring-necked pheasant out of nearby bushes. It flew hurriedly across my path, giving off a rattling, loose-throated cry. Reaching the boundary of Kawaloa, I turned right onto the gravel driveway used by fishermen to reach the shore, and ran downhill past the caretaker's vegetable garden and the apartments, nearly to the kamani tree. A gust of wind swirled around the base of the tree, carrying particles from the ground into the air and out over the waves of the sea. I stood, transfixed by the scene before me. Some of the flowers Jan had left for Mom lofted on the wind and were carried out to sea. A childhood memory flickered back to me, from the time I was 4 or 5, of a plaintive, beautiful song my mother used to sing for me, Red Wing, a song that always made me cry. In that song, an Indian brave who was died in battle lies beneath a tree in a distant land. While living at Kawaloa, I began work on a new novel, Prisoners of Arion. Following my 13 months of work on Man of Two Worlds, Dad was working on it in California. He telephoned me regularly with questions and comments to tell me how it was going, but I wasn't left with enough writing to do. Hence, a new project. Prisoners of Arion was to be about an 11-year-old girl whose mother was generally thought to be psychotic and dangerous. The girl would refuse to believe this, seeing wonderful things in her mother that no one else seemed able to see. It would be set against a highly unusual science fiction backdrop, but the story would in reality be mainstream. I realized this was a big risk, since the story didn't hinge upon any aspect of science, which traditionally was a requirement of science fiction. In my story, the characters would be the main focus. In one of my conversations with Dad about Man of Two Worlds, he reported, "It's going well. I've got prosek in deep fecal matter." One of our characters in the story, a dream alien named Prosek, had changed the shape of his body for security purposes, taking the form of a snake. Dad wrote a passage in which Prosek, while in that shape, was caught in a sliding door and then run over by a power mower. "It sounds like you're having an immensely good time," I said. "I'm enjoying it," he said. Reports on Dune movie revenues in the United States were coming in, and were not good. Facts began to filter in, some of which were provided by Harlan Ellison in his fantasy and science fiction articles. During the production of the movie, Universal Studios underwent a change in management. After the new president saw the film for the first time at a private screening, he stood up and said the movie was a dog and was going to bomb. Shockwaves went out. Advanced screenings had been scheduled for the fall of 1984, with movie reviewers all over the country, and most were now canceled. Only reviewers the company thought would write favorably about the film were permitted to see it. This built a large pool of resentment in those who had been excluded, as might be expected. In early November 1984, a story surfaced in Variety that Dino De Laurentiis was offering a large portion of the movie to investors through a securities dealer in New York City. Was this to spread his risk? Had he lost faith in the film? There were no clear answers. Initially, Dino De Laurentiis promised a movie to compare with Gone with the Wind. In the midst of production, it was said to be the most expensive film ever produced. It had the most elaborate and costly special effects ever attempted, and was one of the most heavily promoted films in history, with secrecy about the cast and a variety of attendant merchandising schemes. Now, with everyone running scared, people began to wonder if it would be the biggest flop in Hollywood history. After all the hype, the over-merchandising, the manipulation and secrecy, and now the canceling of advance showings, many American reviewers were ready to pick the movie apart the moment they saw it. A film critic for the New York Times said the actors in desert stillsuits resembled Groucho Marx, while another said the sets in the movie were suggestive of the interior of the old Roxy Theater. Another reviewer said the movie had the feel of a seventh-grade science project run amok. Roger Ebert said the sandworms looked as if they came out of the same factory that produced Kermit the Frog, having the same mouths. The movie was called a total mess, a failed attempt, a gigantic turkey, ponderous, tedious, confusing, incomprehensible, witless, and overblown. Like carrion, they piled on, and many of the criticisms were unfair to David Lynch, a man who had attempted to film a faithful interpretation of the book. His effort resulted, unfortunately, in a film that was nearly 5 hours long. Too long for commercial success, movie moguls thought. They began cutting it up, paring it down to barely more than 40% of Lynch's work, a little over 2 hours. As a result, too many scenes from the book were missing, left lying on the cutting room floor. On screen, some of the characters and events came out of nowhere without proper background. But even with the cuts, the movie was not nearly as bad as U.S. reviewers wanted the public to believe. Director David Lynch and director of photography Freddie Francis did put their trademark on the film, bringing a somber darkness to the screen. According to The Making of Dune, a promotional book written by Ed Naha for the Dino De Laurentiis Corporation, the art director Tony Masters said, "Dino visited the set one day when it was being built, and he was very worried about the film being too gloomy and black-looking. He wanted everything lightened up, more color. As I was lightening things up and putting more color around, David showed up. He wanted things darker. So I was struck between the two of them. Eventually, we compromised. A little. Dino has accepted everything now. I don't know if he gave up on us or what." Considering this with 2020 hindsight, it does seem to me that the film might have benefited by more light, emphasizing the blinding brilliance of the desert planet a la the film Lawrence of Arabia, instead of cave-dark CHs and gloomy castles. People who had not even seen the movie began talking about how awful it was and how dismally it compared with the book. They saw no point in actually going to see the film and forming their own opinions. A pack mentality set in, and anger surged through the science fiction community over what Hollywood had done to the book they all treasured, Dune. There were excellent reviews, but only a few. Not nearly enough to turn the tide. The Washington Post, Newsweek, and USA Today gave it rave notices. The Seattle Times called it spellbinding and a miraculous transformation of a difficult classic. Comparisons were drawn between the work of David Lynch and Federico Fellini. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer said it was the single most audacious space extravaganza to come along since Kubrick's 2001. Dune received only one Academy Award nomination, for Best Sound Recording, but lost to Amadeus. The lack of recognition from the Academy was a great disappointment to my father and to the filmmakers. When I discussed it with Dad in late March 1985, he said he felt that as a very minimum the picture should have won Best Sound, as well as Best Visual Effects, and perhaps Best Costumes. If singer Michael Jackson had been a member of the Academy, he might have voted for Dune. After seeing the costumes in the movie, he had similar clothing designed for himself, which he wore on stage. "It should have been nominated for Best Picture," Dad said. But he added quickly, "Don't worry about it. The movie's doing beautifully in Europe." He said that U.S. and worldwide revenues were around $80 million so far, and that Dino De Laurentiis was considering a sequel. "We heard that the film was breaking box office records in Europe, Japan, Australia, South Africa, and Indonesia. In the United States, it was showing in more than 700 theaters." There was a lot of confusion about how much revenue the film was generating and about how much it needed to make before it would show a profit. Since Dad's future share, if any, was based upon a percentage of profit, this was of prime concern to him. At one point, he said the film needed to generate $45 million in revenues to show a profit. Another time, he thought it needed $85 million. After completing its theater run in the United States, the film did become one of the top U.S. video rentals. This was not enough, and the producers disseminated earnings statements to us showing a wash of red ink. Based upon early rough cuts my father saw, with more scenes than were included in the finished product, he had spoken of how much he liked the film, of how it was a visual feast and a testament to David Lynch's genius.
Now he joined the grumblers and spoke angrily about the cuts that had been made, including the missing banquet scene, and about the missing character developments on Stilgar and others.
"They cut the hell out of it," Dad said. He also disputed the characterization of Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, who was depicted in a somewhat laughable, cartoonish fashion, when he should have been a terrifying presence. The ending disturbed him as well. He had never given the protagonist Paul Muad'Dib the omnipotent power to make rain, as depicted in the end of the movie. The conclusion of the book was much better, he thought, leaving Paul with less godlike, more human qualities. In the book, the emphasis was on Jessica's last line, reflecting human female concerns. While we, Cheney, we who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives. Living at Kawaloa for 5 months allowed me to understand what my parents had experienced there. I found a sameness to life on this side of Maui. Weeks and days flowed by, meshing into one long moment. The surf pounded against the shore incessantly and timelessly, to the point where I often didn't notice it. And I remembered something my father used to say about Mexico when we lived there. Days blend softly casual into one another. It was very similar here. Each morning, Jan looked out upon the incredible beauty of Kawaloa and said, in a bemused tone, "Ho-hum, another day in paradise." The native Hawaiians were deeply superstitious, in constant fear of incurring the anger of malevolent spirits. When this belief system was combined with Christianity, the resulting amalgam produced interesting practices, such as one described for us by Dad's friends Ed and Jeannie Peachin. Shortly after the construction of their house in the early 1970s, a native Hawaiian man and a Catholic priest came by to perform a ceremony that would rid the home of bad spirits. The Hawaiian uttered a traditional blessing, and in a merging of religious ceremonies, the priest sprinkled holy water in every room. Ed asked the good father where he got his holy water, and received this response, "Oh, I just get it out of the creek. Then I boil the hell out of it." During a time of reflection, I felt like a tiny cell in an infinitely larger cosmic scheme. The rocky shoreline was being worn away by the surf, melting island fragments into the sea, making the land one with the water. I thought of the erosion of the island, of its entropy as it merged with the ocean, and of the entropy of cells within my own body. The amniotic fluid in which I spent my initial months on this planet had the approximate chemical composition of seawater. I heard the surf now, a sudden roar. It filled my mind, washing away all thoughts. One afternoon, while reading in a corner of the living room, I heard the wind picking up in intensity. The pole house creaked and popped around me. A stand of banana fronds outside the dining room moved to the left in unison, curling their leafy fingers away from the wind force that came from the sea. Suddenly, in a powerful blast of air, the fronds went all the way over, flat against the hillside. Rain began pattering on the roof. "Here it comes," I said to Jan. I hadn't been in a tropical downpour since my last trip to the interior of Mexico in 1968, but I knew the signs. The rain intensified, jackhammering the roof and slanting from right to left across my line of sight. I felt the house move beneath me and shudder, as from a moderate earthquake. Then the rain and wind subsided, as quickly as they had appeared. This weather was of a hard-edged variety, with definition to it. It didn't tiptoe around. It shouted at you, demanded your attention. Sometimes I rose quite early, and on such occasions I saw what used to greet my father at the start of each workday in Kawaloa. One glorious dawn, the water seen from the house was deep blue with white lacy foam along the shore's black volcanic edge. The horizon was pastel orange, streaked in gray. Above that hovered a horizontal cloud layer, dark gray and foreboding. Atop that, a pastel blue sky stretched into infinity. The residents of the area had a mañana mentality, my phrase based upon the Spanish word for tomorrow, mañana. Nothing was hurried in Hana, and any haole, white person from outside who tried to get anything done on a schedule, became an object of derision. My father understood this from attempts to have his home constructed on schedule, and from trying to get his car repaired expeditiously. One day in Hasegawa's general store, I overheard a tourist woman asking one of the clerks for a copy of the Honolulu Star Bulletin. "Do you want today's paper or yesterday's?" inquired the clerk, a plump Hawaiian woman. "I'd like today's, please." "Then come back tomorrow," the clerk said, in her pidgin English. Of all the Hawaiian islands, Hana had the second highest concentration of the pure Hawaiian ethnic group, second only to the small island of Niihau. An incredible number of locals were related to one another. I spoke with one woman, a waitress at the Hotel Hana Maui, who told me she had more than 100 cousins, most of them living along the Hana Road. And I met an elderly Hawaiian gentleman who said he had 2,000 members in his extended family, living all through the Hawaiian Islands. His great-grandfather had maintained 7 wives simultaneously. Everywhere I turned, it seemed, someone was saying, "That's my cousin." When Chapter House Dune came out in hardcover in the spring of 1985, it immediately hit national and international bestseller lists. Fan letters poured in, especially prompted by the stirring tribute to my mother. Dad's personal life came together while we were in Hawaii. He asked Teresa Shackelford to marry him, and she accepted. They talked about getting married in the same Reno chapel where Jan and I had taken our vows in 1967. Dad felt that if our marriage had lasted so long from such unpretentious beginnings, his might be similarly blessed. But in Reno, they had difficulty locating our chapel, and were married instead in a different chapel near the courthouse on May 18, 1985. Now he had completed nearly all of the wishes on my mother's list, but he still had not purchased a house on Mercer Island near me. With this in mind, he asked permission to stay in our Mercer Island home while we were in Hawaii, and from that base of operations, he began to look for his own place nearby. Since we were living in his place at Kawaloa, this seemed like an appropriate quid pro quo. One morning, while I was riding, Sheila Rast telephoned from the caretaker's house to tell me that a beautiful blue lily, one of my mother's favorite flowers, was in bloom in the upper garden. She said it was a rare occasion, and that the delicate petals, now full in the coolness of morning, would soon wilt in direct sunlight. I hurried up the hill with a camera. Chapter 44, And a Snowy Good Morning to You. Upon returning from Hawaii in late June, Jan and I lunched with my father at a small sandwich shop. He and Teresa were living in an apartment now, but were in the process of purchasing a house on Mercer Island. He was fighting an apparent case of stomach flu, and had visited the doctor that morning. Whatever he had was hanging on tenaciously, though he was feeling better than the week before. The following weekend, Dad stopped by my house with the Man of Two Worlds manuscript, prepared on his word processor system. We spent 2 hours going over 319 pages that he had completed. Then he left them with me for editing and rewriting. The title, Man of Two Lives, kept going through his mind, he said, but I wasn't enthusiastic about it. I suggested Man of Two Visions as an alternative, mentioning, however, that one of the characters in his unpublished Circle Times manuscript was an Indian named Two Visions. He rejected that title, saying he tried to avoid Latin-rooted words, especially in titles. Given a choice between Latin and Germanic-based words, he said to choose Germanic, since it was more closely allied with English. Many fans, upon reading Man of Two Worlds, assumed that I wrote the humorous passages, because of my earlier satirical novels. To a large extent, this is not the case. In the first draft, I wrote it as a serious novel, and Dad later added most of the funny, wacky stuff. He complimented me on 2 passages I had written in Man of Two Worlds, one involving the headquarters of the French Foreign Legion, and the other about a character dying and melting into the superheated soil of Venus. Another passage I had written, involving a giant spider, had technical problems. Dad said a spider wouldn't scale up, since it couldn't support great weight without a skeleton. We would rewrite the scene with this in mind. My father had been working on Man of Two Worlds in my old office at the insurance agency, by arrangement with my former boss, Hal Cook. Hal's fiancée, Jean Riggenberg, was a realtor, and she was handling the purchase of the Mercer Island house. Because of all their help, Dad wanted to dedicate the book to them. I concurred. As I reviewed the first 210 pages of the Man of Two Worlds material my father had given me, I found it fairly clean and surprisingly in line with what I had already written. In a number of places, however, Dad inserted words I either didn't understand or had never seen before. When reading his work, I always kept a dictionary handy. On June 30th, 1985, the day after my birthday, Dad and I worked on Man of Two Worlds at my house for 2 hours. It was going well, and he concurred with most of the changes I suggested. The major bone of contention surrounded our feminine protagonist, Nishi D'Amato. In Dad's rewrite, he had her aggressively pursuing our protagonist, Lutt Hansen Jr., to the point where I felt it was out of her character. She was, I told him, a virgin, and would know of Lutt's reputation as a womanizer. In the end, Dad came around to my way of thinking, except he still wanted Nishi to be highly interested in Lutt's money. We also argued over a wild scene he wrote involving the French Foreign Legion going from Venus to Earth in order to protect the honor of a solitary woman, Nishi. I thought it was too far-fetched, and said this would deplete forces the Legion needed for military engagements on Venus. But Dad said the Legion would do this for honor. He mentioned an actual historical incident involving besieged legionnaires in the desert. 100 men were trapped, but for honor they still sent out a squad of 10 men to retrieve the bodies of 6 fallen comrades. We reached a compromise. In our story, legionnaires would perform the mission, but with only a small force. Dad said he had to delay his Himalayan expedition for a year, until the spring of 1987. The Nepal government was edgy about having foreign journalists in the country, and he didn't want to go in under false colors. "I've enlisted the aid of Sir Edmund Hillary," he said. Around this time, Bill Ransom told me he wrote 3 chapters of The Ascension Factor, didn't feel good about them, and rewrote them almost entirely. He said also this collaboration would be the first of the 3 in which neither he nor my father were experiencing a personal crisis. Bill had been in the throes of a marital breakup during the writing of the Jesus incident, and Mom had been seriously ill when The Lazarus Effect was written. Unfortunately, Bill spoke too soon. The Mercer Island house transaction closed in the second week of July 1985, and Dad and Teresa were able to move in. We made the move a family affair. It was an unusual one-story home, with metal siding and a huge vaulted dome in the middle of the structure that gave it, perhaps appropriately, the appearance of a flying saucer. My father, true to form, had extensive remodeling plans and enlisted the help of Jan to do the interior decorating. In this endeavor, Jan would meet with him and Teresa regularly to determine what would best suit their needs and tastes. It was a hot day, and toward the end of it, when the moving was nearly complete, we saw Dad sitting on a chair in his study, staring blankly at unopened boxes all around him. I thought he was just tired, but he said he was still having trouble with his stomach and thought it was either an enzyme problem involving milk products or chemical poisoning from a tainted California watermelon he had eaten. There had been a recent watermelon recall. 2 days later, I was visiting my father, standing with him beneath a carport in front of his house. He had a Band-Aid on the vein of one arm and said he had been in for a complete medical checkup. "They gave me an EKG," he said cheerily. "A blood test? Everything. The doctor even held 2 fingers up next to one of my ears, looked through the other ear, and saw the fingers." A short while afterward, he held both hands in front of himself, palms open, and exclaimed, "Don't touch me, nurse. I'm sterile." And he laughed boisterously. On the morning of Friday, July 12th, 1985, Dad dropped off pages he had printed through number 432 for my review. He wore white tennis shoes, blue jeans, and a dark blue Gore-Tex coat, open at the front to reveal a gray and blue Ralph Lauren polo shirt. Today, as he often did recently, he wore a dark gray Irish cap with a brim all the way around. Without his luxuriant beard, he looked old. His skin seemed thinner and more wrinkled, with age spots on his hands. I recalled a time only 12 years earlier when he was 52, and a woman had commented that he looked young enough to be my brother. I never thought of him as old before my mother died, but afterward he seemed to age with frightening rapidity. His short-term memory became increasingly bad, although typically he could recall events vividly from 50 years before. Despite the recent travails of his life and the diminishment of the familiar burly man in the beard, he still walked briskly wherever he went, with a youthful spring in his step. As we sat in my family room, Dad estimated our book would reach 600 typed pages, leaving us around 1/3 to go. We discussed what he called seeds, or loaded guns, in the story. These were dispersed throughout the early pages to be used later. A character trait, for example, that might come in handy later to solve a crisis, or the beginnings of a problem that would ultimately have to be resolved. Overall, despite occasional mild disagreements over the course of the story, we worked smoothly together. We shared many fine and memorable times, when his study or mine was filled with laughter. In the process, we put together some wildly hilarious scenes. In the midst of all the activity around Dad and the book we were writing, I never really got to know his new wife. She and I acknowledged one another politely, but then one or the other of us rushed off alone with Dad to do this or that. I knew Teresa had an interest in popular music, because I heard it on the stereo system as I came in the door. And she showed special attention to Margot, giving her several children's books. Teresa had a passion for books, though she had been forced to leave her job in that industry in order to be with Dad. He said she spoke of wanting to collect rare books. Most of the Man of Two Worlds sessions were at my father's house, in a study he set up in a small room at the rear. He had a rustic black desk on one wall, with a single bookshelf holding books about Nepal and mountain climbing, along with the Dune movie clapboard. Along the opposite wall were his word processor and printer, and to the left of that was a closet with an immense fire safe inside. A brass lamp stood on a shelf over the word processor. On the floor by the window sat the framed list of national bestsellers from earlier in the year, showing Dune as number one. He would sit in front of his Compaq computer, with its black lettering on a light green screen, and I, not knowing how to use a computer at the time, sat in a chair to his left with notes on my lap. The dot matrix printer was set up in front of me, with a large box of tractor feed computer paper beneath it on the floor. He couldn't seem to beat the stomach problem. I heard it making noises as we sat together, a growling, squeezing sound, and sometimes he complained about it. We were frequently interrupted by telephone calls. One came in from comedian Tommy Smothers, calling from Petaluma, California. The men had met in the past year, and while I waited, they spoke of getting together in Hawaii or in Australia, both destinations on a trip Dad was planning to take after our book was completed. The conversation was witty and jovial. Another call came in from Warner Brothers Recordings, who wanted to do a 6-hour cassette covering, in abbreviated form, the stories in all 6 Dune books. Dad was interested, but said he didn't have time to do the script. They spoke of hiring another writer for that task. Dad's literary agent was suggesting the creation of a special book to go along with the recordings, presenting shorter versions of the stories, and Dad and I kicked around the possibility of doing it together. Other calls came in from foreign literary and film agents, and from reporters wanting to interview him, and always he took time out to handle whatever they wanted with great patience. In one of the telephone interviews with a Salt Lake City newspaper,